Hunting dovetails with almost every story I've reported on the Endangered Species Act. We started this season talking about the impacts of the growing grizzly population where I live in southwest Montana. Those impacts stretch to ranchers and also extend to the risk calculus of folks like hunters who sneak around in grizzly country in search of elk.
We have a buddy that gave us some info on some spots to hunt, and he said, you know, if things aren't coming together.
He said if you have balls big as dump truck tires, go ahead and go in there because there's grizzly bears.
Jake and Maurice are an ER doctor and nurse from Massachusetts. I ran into them watching grizzlies in that pullout I took you to earlier this season, where people hang out, have picnics, and watch bears. The two had spent a long day archery hunting nearby.
We researched it. And it's a calculated risk. You know, we live in Massachusetts, you know, like near Chatham, and there's sharks, but we still go swimming. That's the way I look at it. There's more shark attacks than bear attacks here.
A lot more bears here today.
I've never seen a great white, but I've seen five bears today.
A few weeks later, our producer Mary and I went back up to that grizzly viewing zone and met a guy named Ray. He said he's a hunting guide in the area and didn't want to give his last name.
You're just overrun with bears. Something needs to be done. You can't even walk out on your porch without worrying about a bear.
He was watching elk on a distant hillside while we had our binoculars fixed on a grizzly bear in the meadow below.
When you say something needs to be done, what do you mean?
Their numbers need to be thinned out, or they need to be moved to California.
This, to be clear, is a joke. He's getting at the idea that tourists from big cities on the coast come here to watch bears with no regard for what it's like to live in a landscape laden with them. He told me he's had some scary encounters with bears, just doing work in the field, while on horseback, or out hunting.
I get charged a lot by these darn things, and it's just getting to the point where I'm starting to get tired of it.
I mean, I think it doesn't take all that much to get tired of being charged by a grizzly bear.
Would you be happy if they were totally gone?
No, I don't think they should be totally gone. I just think they need to be managed.
You mean like let people hunt them?
Yes.
If there was a hunt, would you put in for it?
It's classified information.
From Montana Public Radio and the Montana Media Lab, this is The Wide Open. Our first season, all about the Endangered Species Act, is called Threatened. I'm Nick Mott. This time, how does and doesn't hunting serve conservation? Stay with us. To start out, I need to tell you a little about my own relationship with hunting. I am a hunter, albeit a pretty new one. I came to it in my 30s, and I don't hunt for trophies. Like the vast majority of hunters in the U.S., I hunt for meat, elk and deer mostly. Growing up in Kansas, family members hunted, but I never really got it. When I moved to Montana, it seemed like it was everywhere. More than 1 in 5 people hold a hunting license here. So if you're in a coffee shop or a bar or a restaurant, chances are good you're seeing a lot of camo shirts and heads mounted on the wall. I mean, one of my first dates with my partner was grinding up some deer meat she'd harvested. And when I did start hunting, I fell for it, hard.
A gorgeous, gorgeous day. A lot of elk sign, but no elk.
Hunting, I slow down. I watch as the land wakes up and falls back asleep. I go places I'd never otherwise be and experience things I otherwise never would. I'm still figuring out its role in my life. And as a relatively new hunter, I'm deeply curious about it. Our journey here doesn't start in Montana, where there's all that controversy over wolves and bears. Instead, we're headed to Texas. One Endangered Species Act story here, over an animal that's not even native to the United States, foregrounds the complications and tension between killing animals and saving species.
We are currently on Sela Bamberger Ranch Preserve here in Blanco County, Texas.
We're in Texas Hill Country, about an hour from Austin. And this is April Sansom, executive director of the ranch. The landscape here is relatively arid, with the occasional clear stream and limestone outcrops among its abundant namesake hills. Shortly after you drive into the ranch, you pass, of all things, a gravestone.
It is an actual tombstone that we're looking at here, but nobody's buried here. The tombstone says, "In memory of man, 2 million BC, to AD 20 question mark. He who once dominated the earth destroyed it with his wastes, his poisons, and his own numbers.
This focus on death is an odd welcome to a place dedicated to saving nature. A guy named David Bamberger bought this land back in the late 1960s. He'd come into money selling vacuums and then fried chicken. He founded the chain Church's Chicken, actually. And though his fortune came from fast food, he was a conservationist at heart. He'd seen the damage we'd wrought on the natural world, hence that headstone, and he wanted to restore the land. He put this headstone in 1973, actually the same year the Endangered Species Act passed. There's an anecdote about it April loves to tell. Bamberger, who she calls Mr. B, wrote this inscription on an index card and put it into his shirt pocket. He went to see a stonemason to get the headstone engraved.
Mr. B walks into the shop. The stonemason takes his hat off and says, "Sir, who will we be memorializing today?" And Mr. B pulls the index card out of his pocket, hands it to the gentleman. Gentleman reads it, takes a second to read it, puts his hat back on, looks up at Mr. B and says, "Well, I'll be darned." Says, "I have buried parakeets, cats, dogs, horses, lots and lots and lots of people, but never before have I buried the entire human race."
So this is the tone that's set as you enter the Bamberger Ranch. Probably not the tone you expected in a story that's about hunting. Over the decades, the team at the ranch has put in a tremendous amount of work to restore and conserve the entire ecosystem here. They've gotten rid of non-native cedar trees, reestablished native grasses and other flora. And as they've done that work, biodiversity here has soared. Surveys of the land decades ago revealed only about 50 bird species coming through. Today, more than 200 species utilize the habitat on the ranch.
The idea is that we are good stewards of our land, and our mission as a nonprofit is to share that land stewardship through outreach and education. And so there's pieces of that that may not intuitively strike people as important, like the hunting program, for example.
So hunting, yeah. They allow a limited amount of that here, mostly for white-tailed deer that can overgraze all that healthy, restored grass. But it's no destination for trophy hunting. Hunting here, April says.
It's a very important part of our land stewardship to remove some of those hungry mouths off the landscape that put too much pressure on the vegetation.
I wanted to talk specifically about one species that has a home on the ranch, the scimitar horned oryx. They're not hunted here, but stick with me. Hunting is very important in their story. You've probably never seen an oryx, since they're a near-extinct animal that once upon a time kicked around lots of northern Africa. They have the body shape of a horse or a zebra, but have 2 3-foot-long horns, black and sharp. The texture looks almost as if they've been wound in twine. Legend has it, they inspired the myth of the unicorn.
In profile, you might think that animal only had one horn. And that is where that legend is thought to have stemmed from.
The scimitar-horned oryx got listed as endangered under the ESA in 2005. This is a weird thing about the law. Not all creatures that make the list are American. At the ranch here, they raise a conservation herd, meaning it's a source population, or a carefully monitored herd that could one day get transplanted back into the wild in the animal's native range in Africa.
We like to kind of joke that here in Central Texas, they're living it up here. They have some nice forage to eat, and they don't have to fight off any lions.
And the story of the oryx here at the Bamberger Ranch and all across Texas comes back to the weird links between hunting, conservation, and the Endangered Species Act. I met Stephen Fulton in a cabin near the ranch's entrance. He's manager and biologist here. He helps take care of the oryx herd and a whole lot more.
It is very difficult to describe what I do on a day-to-day basis, because every day is different. yesterday I was laying some new water line. So I was gluing together PVC pipe and throwing it down in a trench. Today I'm on a podcast with somebody from Montana.
Exotic animals have a long history in Texas. Since the 1920s, the industry around raising and hunting exotic animals there has exploded. From emus to bongos, nilgai and mouflon, axis deer and attuxes, kudus and zebras, Texas is home to at least 130 exotic species, and people are willing to pay top dollar to private game ranches for the privilege of hunting many of them, pumping hundreds of millions of dollars into the local economy. When it comes to the oryx in particular, the animal was actually, for a time, extinct in Africa. And there are way, way more of them in Texas, grazing on grass behind high fences and conservation herds like this one, or on game ranches, than there are in the wild.
Tell me, you know, the bigger picture of the oryx program, like why and how it happens.
Well, this, to start off with, it was actually to save the species.
Back in the 1980s, well before it got ESA protection, the oryx in the wild wasn't doing very well. Hunting, competing with cattle, and the destruction of habitat put the writing on the wall. The end for the species was near. So a few decades ago, zoologists and wildlife managers got together to figure out what to do.
So they had this big meeting, confab, if you want to call that, at the San Antonio Zoo.
Oryx had been captured in the wild and placed in zoos all over the world, including in Texas.
One of the top priorities was, well, we need to gather as many animals as we can, as diverse a genetic population as we can, to one place big enough to start this breeding program.
David Bamberger was on the board of the San Antonio Zoo at the time, and he just so happened to know a place.
Mr. Bamberger raised his hand and said, I'd like to help. I got a big ranch not too far from here. How can I help? So they sent out their ecologists and biologists, and they surveyed the ranch and said, well, with all the grass restoration that you've performed here, grassland restoration, a grazing animal would be, you know, it'd be a cinch. So the scimitar horned oryx was picked, and they brought us 28 animals. Those 28 animals represented 31 different bloodlines that they had records of. And we began the species survival program, which is basically just a breeding program, keeping track of the genetics.
So these animals raised here on the Bamberger Ranch are a potential source population for their native range in Africa. And to be clear, even though they have that whitetail harvest program, this is not a hunting ranch. But the animals do have to keep reproducing, and the ranch can only hold so many oryx. So what do you do with the extras? They decided they'd sell them. It would generate the money they needed to keep the animals alive and give them a home on the ranch. The weirder part is the buyers. Those with the money to spare to buy oryx and raise them are mostly hunting ranches, where clients pay thousands to shoot and kill the animals. So even though the Bamberger Ranch's oryx herd is dedicated to saving the species, they send some of them off to very likely die at Texas hunting ranches. In this roundabout way, their oryx conservation program is tied up with oryx hunting. The idea is, if some individual oryx dies, that's just part of the whole deal. The species still goes on. But this has long been a controversial idea. And in 2012, that controversy came to a head in the form of a lawsuit. It was from a group called Friends of Animals. This is Priscilla Farrell, president of the group on 60 Minutes back in those days.
They're breeding these antelopes. They're selling the antelopes, and they're killing the antelopes, and they're calling it conserving them. They're saying it's an act of conservation, and that's lunacy.
Friends of Animals is a group that has long challenged hunting. Their website says, and I'm quoting here, that killing is not conservation. Protection of habitat and reintroduction of threatened and endangered species is. And to be clear, the ESA typically doesn't allow hunting of listed animals. What happened is this. When the animals got ESA protections in 2005, the government allowed the continued hunting of the species in Texas because it provided for the conservation of the species back in its native range. It was kind of a loophole. But Priscilla's group claimed the government wasn't enforcing the letter of the law, so they sued. And in the courts, that loophole got closed.
That basically meant that the scimitar horned oryx could not be hunted anymore.
Here's Priscilla Farrell on 60 Minutes again.
I think it's obscene. I don't think you create a life to shoot it.
So if the animals exist only to be hunted,
right,
you would rather they not exist at all?
Not in Texas, no.
Suddenly, seemingly out of nowhere, the full force of the ESA stopped oryx hunting in its tracks. Hunters and breeders of oryx, including here at the Bamberger Ranch, were up in arms.
I did not think it was the right thing to do.
The reason was this. If there's no oryx hunting on game ranches, then the Bamberger folks would have no buyers for their surplus animals. And without that income from selling those critters they didn't have room for, they wouldn't be able to keep their conservation program going. Remember, this is a source population for oryx, meant to help reestablish the population in the wild. So the decline of oryx in Texas could link up directly with the continued decline of the species in Africa.
For us, because we didn't know where all the chips were going to fall, we completely stopped our breeding. We didn't put any of the males in with the females. It just made it difficult. It just made it extremely difficult to conserve the species. It was not a good time. It was a very stressful time for anybody that was trying to conserve the animals, trying to figure out why, what can be done to keep that conservation rolling in a positive direction. And it just didn't. All conservation pretty much halted and stopped. On private ranches across the state, the numbers dramatically were decreased.
Putting a stop to hunting, ending the killing of these animals, the argument went, would actually lead to their extinction. The battle really wasn't just about hunting. It was about how we conserve species, and especially how we fund that conservation. And these two things, at once killing and saving animals, have been bound up with one another for over a century. That story, after the break.
The Wide Open is supported by the Murray and Jan Ritland Fund, the Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and listeners like you. Ways to contribute and make this kind of journalism possible at mtpr.org.
Welcome back to The Wide Open. We're going to leave oryx behind for a good long while, but they'll be back, don't worry. First, we need to take a look back into the world of conservation and hunting history. And we'll have two guides for this journey. I met our first, Hal Herring, at his office in the town of Augusta, Montana, population about 300, which he oddly shares with some of the city's services.
Is that a fax?
It's a fax. This is Augusta Water and Sewer.
Gotcha.
And some of the ambulance, too.
He's a contributing editor at Field & Stream magazine. He runs Backcountry Hunters and Anglers podcast, and he's working on a book about the history of our public lands. I'll call him a sort of philosopher hunter. Archery season was coming up, and we pretty quickly got into just talking hunting. Specifically, the elk rut, when they're bugling and mewing and mating and fighting. To both of us, it's a magical time to be out in the woods.
You are in the essence of the life force. This is how it goes on. This is how the thing keeps going. And when you see those bull elk and they're like, they've like pissed on themselves and they're covered, slathered with mud into those, like, they're almost like pagan deities, right? And then they're bellowing and they will fight to the death for the right to mate. And you're if that ain't the life force, you know, if you wanted to reach out and touch the energy of creation, there it is.
Basically, Hal lives and breathes hunting. He still remembers the chemical smell of the soybean field back where he grew up in Alabama, where he shot one of his first birds.
There's that thing about art where it says the entire process of your art is to search for the place where your soul first awakened. That is kind of where my soul first awakened.
Our other guide is Nicole Qualtieri. I met her at her house near Anaconda, Montana. She was getting ready to throw some venison on her cast iron when I arrived.
I have the two tri-tips from my 2023 mule deer here. I dry brined them overnight. Basically going to be a create your own meal with sourdough that I make myself. That was my New Year's resolution, was to learn how to make bread. So I guess I'm always thinking about how I can be involved in my food system.
Nicole spent about a decade working for the hunting TV show Meat Eater, and she recently started up her own publication dedicated to thinking and writing about hunting and conservation, called The Western. Like me, Nicole is an adult onset hunter. She'd never fired a gun before she was 30, but a backpacking trip in elk country left her curious to learn more.
I didn't know if I could kill an animal. I lost my dad to cancer when I was 15 years old, and so I had this really deep death anxiety for a long time.
Of course, she's saying this at the same time she's cutting a deer steak. She recognizes the irony here.
I've killed, and I'm very intentional about using the word kill. I think that when we are able to look at death, it doesn't have the same ominous sense of the Grim Reaper anymore. When death becomes purposeful, it changes the way you're able to live, because the scary dark thing is now the meat on your table and the thing that is giving you energy to continue. At the end of the day, it's like, I get to kill that mule deer because of what hunting has done for conservation too. And I think that that is another important thing to talk about, is the history. And this isn't a history that people are given in school.
That history lesson starts way back in the early days of the Republic.
We threw off the shackles of England, and we never wanted it to be like the King's Game again.
Describe what you mean when you say the King's Game.
If you've ever read, like, The Sheriff of Nottingham and Robin Hood and Little John, right? Where they're in Sherwood Forest, and their primary crime is poaching the king's deer with bows and arrows.
Hand over that boy.
And what has the boy done?
He was caught poaching in the king's forest. He dared to kill a king's deer. Dared to kill a king's deer.
The wildlife belonged to the monarchy, to the king, not to the people.
And so that whole Robin Hood myth or story is about the king's deer. And so when the United States threw off those shackles in 1776, one of the first things we said was, the game belongs to those who need it. It's a public resource. That led to a sort of traditional tragedy of the commons, where you have, like, ships loaded with canvasbacks going to the Fulton Street Fish Market in New York to go to all the hotels.
This is the story of the market hunt. This is the extirpation of wolves. It's the extirpation of bison. It's the extirpation of grizzly bears.
Thousands, tens of thousands of passenger pigeons being harvested with huge nets and explosives. Sturgeon being harvested like that. Everything being harvested like that. And of course, we came to the end of that experiment in infinite bounty. In some places right away, in some places it took longer.
Killing wildlife was part of international commerce. Buffalo hide provided leather for industrial-strength belts in England. The fashion industry, in particular, played a big role in this mass extirpation. Take, for instance, hats. Beaver pelt hats were all the rage, and tens of millions of the animals were killed to fuel the craze. By the 1870s, ornate, feathery women's headpieces were in vogue, and to outfit them, as many as 5 million birds a year were killed. There were no laws governing these hunts. Across the country, and in particular as the West was colonized, there was a sort of free-for-all for game. Hunting was ravaging the country.
I think people would have a hard time imagining the kind of frenzy of destruction of the wild game resources at the end of the Civil War through the time, say, 1891, where people started going like, wait a minute.
For millennia, much of the Western world had a religious mindset toward extinction. Humans were put on the planet as part of God's perfect creation, and nothing in his divine order could go extinct at all. But those views changed as the fast-growing United States saw the possibility of extinction all around. As populations of bison and deer and elk and bears and wolves and fish and birds plummeted, the push against those declines ramped up. Sportsmen's groups, essentially hunting organizations, formed around the country. They started advocating for change, things like hunting laws and regulations that could ensure species persist. These, in lots of ways, were the country's earliest precursors to the Endangered Species Act. Laws meant to make sure we didn't repeat the mistakes of our past.
It began to change the tide. This is also around the time that Theodore Roosevelt is going into office and creating the National Forest System and creating his version of what hunting should be, which I will tell you is white male and wealthy. And that is also problematic from where we stand now in our culture. But amidst all of the problems that we can now see behind his thinking is also intact ecosystems that allow us to help threatened and endangered species, that allow us to be human in wild spaces.
Our collective reckoning with extinction often came from those witnessing our impact firsthand while out hunting. Like in the late 1800s, Teddy Roosevelt wanted to kill a big bull out of a herd of some of the last remaining wild bison in the country. While on the hunt, he drafted a letter to his wife, describing what he called a sort of half-melancholy feeling as he watched the bison. They were the last remnant, he wrote, of a doomed and nearly vanished race.
This is a national zeitgeist that's building. Teddy Roosevelt said that in the absolute squandering of the nation's resources, he saw a failure of the dream itself, right? He said, the question of natural resources is the primary question. If we cannot solve that one, it behooves us little to solve all the rest.
Like in the 1970s, as Richard Nixon signed the Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act and ESA into law, conservation of our natural resources was in the ether. Those sportsmen's groups successfully advocated for the first game laws. The National Forest System and National Park System began. We collectively began to think about what our actions would mean, not just now, in the moment we're in, but generations down the line.
It's as if we found this unique thing, we destroyed it in record time, and then looked around and instead of going like, so be it, we said, man, it didn't have to be that way. And buddy, it was inconvenient.
It wasn't like this was easy, Hal said. Plenty of people wanted to continue doing what we've been doing. It even got violent. A warden in Florida was murdered while trying to stop poachers from harvesting plumes.
The game wardens were killed. The laws were opposed. The regulations were opposed. But this was a grassroots movement that started the first regulations around wildlife.
And by the early 20th century, these groups worked to pass a monumental piece of law.
My favorite act is the Lacey Act. So we're talking about the Endangered Species Act, but I would say that the great-grandmother of the Endangered Species Act is the Lacey Act. What the Lacey Act did was it took the market out of the market hunt.
The act made all those practices that had fueled the destruction of animals from bison to egrets to elk illegal. You couldn't sell these species across state or international lines.
You cannot sell wild venison. You cannot sell wild birds. Keeping the market out of hunting actually keeps it a public resource. So whenever an animal is hunted here in the United States, that meat has to go to personal use. It cannot be sold.
Like that mule deer steak Nicole and I had for lunch, meat that's hunted in the U.S. doesn't go to the international market for leather or clothes anymore. It goes into the freezers of hunters. It feeds people. And back then, healing the landscape hunters had blasted wide open would require lots more than ending the market hunt and instituting regulations. Hunters, along with much of the public, wanted to bring wildlife back and to keep it around. That required money, and lots of it. There would need to be land acquisitions, game wardens hired, scientists to study wildlife populations. So hunters agreed to taxing themselves. That came not just through buying hunting permits, but through taxes on selling guns and ammo that went straight back to funding state game agencies and wildlife recovery. This formed the backbone of species conservation, and it persists to this day. It's something that, unless you're deep in the policy and conservation world, you probably haven't heard about. It's this system of ideas, all stemming from this era and interrelated with hunting. Over time, it developed a name.
The North American model.
North American model of wildlife management.
The North American model has several interrelated tenets. In a nutshell, wildlife is held in trust for everybody, Everybody has the right to hunt and fish, game meat can't be wasted, wildlife isn't meant for commercial trade, and it should all be guided by the rule of law and informed by the best available science. And bound up with the North American model is hunting's main link to conserving species, funding. Under this model, the people who used public land, hunters, became the great revenue generator for conservation. Today, hunting revenue, through those firearms, tax dollars, hunting licenses, and more, generates as much as 2/3 of wildlife funding for state game agencies across the country. Those taxes have generated tens of billions of dollars that have been used to study wildlife, to acquire millions of acres of public land, and even to reintroduce animals from ducks to elk back to their native range.
It has been primarily through the efforts and money provided by hunters that such once endangered species as our pronghorn antelope and wild turkey are once again plentiful. It is hunters who are fighting to protect and improve waterfowl breeding areas and working hard to save the habitat of all wildlife from the brutal onrush of our industrial civilization.
Hunters went from the instigators of species decline to the instigators of species recovery. They wanted to keep the species they loved and loved to kill from disappearing.
The people like wiped it out. And the people somehow got together and said, like, that's not what we want. It belongs to all of us, and we should be stewards of it.
Right. I mean, that moment seems really interesting to me because we could have gone two ways, right? Like, we had made wildlife a public resource. We could have said, this isn't working, so let's make it private. Let's make it, you know.
Yeah, which everybody else did. So you go to South Africa. And the wildlife is considered the property of the landowner. They fence it in. They have the hunts. They have incredible diversity. And some species are preserved. You go to the European model, Scotland, where you pay, I don't know, $8,000, and you can shoot a stag, or you can go on a driven grouse hunt in the moors. But the United States actually did something utterly different.
We kept it public.
You kept it public, and then the public supported regulating themselves and taxing themselves. They didn't just go like, oh, hell with it. It's easier to just let it go. And boy, was it. They just said, no, that's a betrayal of this, some type of American dream.
Fast forward to today. Hunting is really this flashpoint culturally, right? When grizzlies and wolves get proposed for delisting, when some dentist kills a lion abroad. Like, why does it get such a bad rap today?
We have disarticulated hunting from the conservation that gives it meaning. Association of anti-grizz, anti-wolf, anti-conservation, for Jeebus' sake, right? With hunting? The two things don't fit in the same room. You can't jam them in the same clown car. Hunting doesn't exist without conservation. Hunting and fishing are the interest on the principle of stewarded, sustainably managed, and conserved landscapes. If we don't know that history, I don't know how we're going to go forward.
More after the break. Welcome back to The Wide Open. I'm back in Texas, driving a dirt road through the Bamberger Ranch with Executive Director April Sansom. We stop to watch the herd. I can hear little grunts and harumphs, perfect for a podcast.
Just try and point the mic there and see if they do it again. Of course, they're being quiet now that I'm pointing it at them.
That's right. Murphy's Law of Oryx watching.
We're talking about this herd's role in conservation. I'm taking photos and also just observing this species I've never seen or really even thought about before.
You kind of see that they have a little bit of a marking on their eye. It's almost like a...
like some mascara. Like they're goth.
That's funny. I've never thought of it that way, but that's right.
What's going on in Texas looks a lot more like the model of hunting Hal mentioned in, say, South Africa, than how animals like deer and elk and black bears and mountain lions are managed in most of the U.S. The animals in Texas are private, grazing behind fences too tall to jump over.
We watch as the oryx on the ranch lays in the sun. It's calving season, and little baby oryx walk clumsily near their mothers. Others are still too young and just lay still in the tall grass.
You can tell the baby is curious because he's looking right at us. He kind of wants to see what we are.
Oh my gosh, it's wobbly and cute.
They look like they have to grow into their legs, don't they?
Back in 2014, the oryx hunting ordeal with the Endangered Species Act came to an end. What solved it surprised me when I learned about it, but really shouldn't surprise you if you've listened to the rest of the season. There was a budget bill that had to pass to prevent a federal government shutdown, and a Republican congressional representative from Texas added a rider on that bill to let hunting and selling the oryx continue. So the breeding program here at the Bamberger Ranch goes on, and so does hunting the animal all over Texas. Today, an estimated 12,000 oryx graze the ranch lands of Texas, mostly for hunting. While we're staring at the animals, April gets a call.
Hi, Steven. We're watching oryx.
It's Steven, the manager and biologist. He says there's been a new baby born, and they need to see which mother birthed it, and if it's a boy or a girl. And do we want to join? Absolutely we do. He gives us some instructions.
Okay, we're turning around right now. Okay, 10-4, good buddy.
We drive down the road and we wait. His red truck pulls up and April and I hop into the bed as Steven and Pancho Coronilla, land steward at the ranch, who's earned the nickname the Oryx Whisperer, set out off-road into the field.
Oh, those little beautiful babies.
What ensues is what I can best describe as a Texas-style oryx roundup. As the truck nears the herd, most of the animals scatter. Up close, the animal's horns look especially long, sharp, and menacing. Oryx are known to occasionally kill a lion in the wild and are especially dangerous protecting their young, as in right now. A mama oryx bluff charges the truck. Pretty much everybody but me is unfazed.
She's checking us out. They're doing their jobs as mamas.
There's a chaos of galloping oryx. The baby we're after sticks with its mother at first, but after a few moments, they part ways. Pancho maneuvers the truck in between the two. The baby lays down in the grass. Steven grabs it and hands it to Pancho. The mother looks on from about 20 yards away. They check the sex.
There's the baby. Now we have the baby. Pancho has done this so many times.
Niño.
So they see that the baby is a male.
We don't tag the males.
And see the little nubbins on the head where the horns are going to grow? And then Steven very carefully puts the baby back.
The baby, bounding off on its clumsy legs, reunites with its mother.
And as soon as we drive away from that baby, that mama will come back to that baby and make sure he's okay. Which, of course, he is, because we haven't done anything to him.
If you listen carefully here, you can finally hear all those oryx noises.
There they go, mama and baby off together, like nothing ever happened.
Since 2016, about 600 members of the species have been reintroduced in the wild. They're not technically extinct in their native range anymore. And that's thanks to conservation herds dedicated to keeping the genetics going, like the one at the Bamberger Ranch. There were about 75 oryx on the ranch when I visited, including all those babies. Steven says they can't trace one of their oryx directly to those reintroduced back on the ground in Africa, but that doesn't mean it won't happen.
And now we know that mama, we know her ear tag because we got close enough to her to see it and we used the binoculars. And now we know that she gave birth to a male. It's so important because of the fact that these animals are part of the species recovery program that we need to keep the bloodlines as healthy as possible.
Oryx in Texas are sort of the perfect example of how we've both stuck with the North American model and how we've perverted it in the century since. The animals here are private. They're a lot closer to the king's deer than public elk. But their story also foregrounds maybe the most central link between hunting and conservation: money. Just like with every species managed by states under the North American model, people spending money to kill animals is how we conserve and save species. For the game animals you're probably more used to thinking about, that money comes mostly from hunting licenses and taxes on guns and ammo. Down in Texas, selling oryx to hunting ranches helps fund the conservation herd at the Bamberger Ranch. For better or for worse, the future of this species, and many others,
is bound up with capitalism. Here's Stephen.
Conservation costs money. I mean, there's no conservation that's cheap. So when you're trying to conserve a species, it's a lot easier to conserve that species if it has value other than just let's look at it out of our window of our breakfast nook, right? Mr. Bamberger uses an analogy of the passenger pigeon and the chicken. Well, in our past, in our history of this country, there was a time when there were very few chickens and millions of passenger pigeons. Which one had value? Now we have no more passenger pigeons, and we got millions and millions of chickens, again, because they had value, other than just a species that people like to look at, okay? Not saying that's a bad thing. I wish that altruism was spread across the world. I wish Mr. Bamberger's altruism was what everybody had and could afford to have.
There's something else, too, that unites this sort of hunting and what Hal and Nicole and even I do in Montana. To Nicole, there's a deeper ethical dissonance at play in how we collectively grapple with hunting and its role in the landscape.
I think what it actually comes down to for many people is the question of the individual versus the species. I think as hunters, we live in the place of the species. If I take a mule deer out of the population, I know that the biology and the science has been done on the ground in order to make the case for me to fill a tag.
What she's getting at is this. As humans, we're used to thinking about the worth of individual beings rather than parts of a greater whole. That's probably a really good thing when it comes to how we value one another as people. But when thinking about wildlife, we might need to expand that moral calculus. Hal, as you might expect of him by now, has part of a poem memorized about that notion.
You know the Tennyson quote? It says, "Nature, so careless of the one she seems, so careful of the type." Meaning that like one individual means nothing in a species, in the protection of a species, or in the sustainable ability of a species to remain vibrant. So careless of the one she seems, so careful of the type. A million fruit flies are born every day, and 900,000 of them are eaten by lizards. Mm-hmm. But the species continues.
What's good for an individual, as in staying alive, might not be good for the species in some cases. Take, for example, deer. A given ecosystem can only feed so many animals. When they get overpopulated, they can suffer grisly mass die-offs due to starvation. So hunting, even though it involves killing individuals, can actually prevent a good bit of death and suffering sometimes. Carefully controlled hunts are one way wildlife managers try to seek balance in complex habitats. This is true for oryx, for elk, for deer. And it could even be true for grizzlies if they do get delisted and states go forward with the hunt.
I almost feel like, ethically, if I drew the grizzly bear tag, I would go and hunt it out of the respect for the state management system, out of respect for all of the other animals that interact with that grizzly bear and have made its life what it is.
Nicole means this purely as a thought experiment. She doesn't know if she'd actually want to hunt a grizzly. But in this modern era of conservation-based hunting, hunters in the U.S. haven't driven any species to extinction. The animals we hunt are among the most abundant on the landscape. So Nicole says,
if I were to hunt a grizzly bear and kill a grizzly bear, the grizzly bear is still going to go on, and it's still going to have the population DNA to be a healthy species. We're under this North American model of wildlife management. The hunting doesn't affect the species. It might affect the individual. It does not affect the species.
That's at least assuming the state adopts a science-based management plan, as it's done with other species like deer and elk. The question, ultimately, isn't just how we pay for conservation. It's also how we balance these things, the individual and the collective. This episode comes out about a week before archery season begins here in Montana. So while you're listening to this, it's very possible I'm out there in the mountains, in, like Hal says, the essence of the life force, in awe of the landscape and the animals around me.
piecing all this together for myself. Next time on The Wide Open, an endangered species battle kickstarts the largest dam removal in history.
People started coming down the river yelling, "The fish are dying, the fish are dying."
Why are we losing 80, 90% of our fish? It's the dams. It's the sediment. It's the worms. It's the out of balance nature. And so you see what happens when you put something on the river like that. You take the system into ecological tipping points and you start losing everything.
Welcome to the largest salmon restoration project ever. It's no small thing.
This episode was reported and written by me, Nick Mott. It was produced by Mary Auld with editorial support from Jewel Banville, Lee Banville, and Corin Cates Carney. Our story editor is Lacey Roberts. Jesse Stevenson created art for the season. Our theme music is by Isaac Opatz, arranged and produced by Dylan Rodrigue, featuring Jordan Bush on pedal steel. Other original music is by Dylan Rodrigue. Jake Birch mixed this episode with help from Alice Sauter. Web design and marketing is by Josh Burnham, and fact-checking is by Victoria Traxler. Special thanks to Leah Swartz for the conservation education and support. Also, a huge thank you to April Sansom and Stephen Fulton for welcoming me onto the ranch. There's a whole lot of cool stuff going on there outside the world of Oryx. And also to Hal Herring and Nicole Qualtieri for the excellent conversation. Nicole, that steak was delicious. Please tell your friends about the show. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts, rate us, review us, post about us on social media. Help us get the word out.
This project was produced in collaboration with the Montana Media Lab at the University of Montana School of Journalism. The lab is a center for audio storytelling and journalism education that elevates perspectives from underserved communities in the West. Learn more at montanamedialab.com. The Wide Open is also a production of Montana Public Radio. MTPR enriches the mind and spirit, inspires a lifetime of learning, and connects communities through access to exceptional programming. More information at mtpr.org. The Wide Open is supported by the Murray and Jan Ritland Fund, the Cinnabar Foundation, and Humanities Montana.